Today on the Wrinkled Engineer podcast, Tim returns as the overlord of pronunciation. We're going to look at hazard versus risk. And Everest got an elevation update, and we're going to discuss that as well as the scale of Disneyland's Matterhorn. And we're going to look at a couple additional dangerous items that couldn't be invented today. Welcome to the Wrinkled Engineer podcast. I'm Gates. I'm here with Tim. And Tim is our overlord of pronunciation, and he texted me this combination of words, and I don't know where he's going with it, and I have a feeling I might be saying it wrong because they seem like very normal words, and so it's complex numbers,
right? As in imaginary numbers and so forth from the world of mathematics.
Okay. Correct. So am I saying it wrong?
Like, how could we possibly be doing that wrong? Okay, well, it's interesting here because it gets right down to the concept of what a complex number is. So there's a noun version of the word complex, which means, you know, difficult or intricate or something like that. That's the adjective form. The noun form of it is when you're saying, things that are combined into one thing, like an apartment complex, for example. Now listen to the way you say apartment complex versus the way you say something is complex, where you put the emphasis on the second syllable. So what it does is it really shows that when people are saying complex numbers, it's like they're saying they're difficult numbers or hard to understand or something like that. And that's not the case at all. It's a number that's comprised of two different parts, which combine into a complex. So it's a complex number.
Okay, I see that.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's very subtle.
It's subtle, but it's not, yeah, you're not, you can actually hear the difference if you say it's a complex number as opposed to a complex number.
Yeah, that plex is the difference there.
So if you try it, it'll feel unnatural, more so saying it than listening to it. So yeah. Try to say complex like you're saying an apartment complex, and then it'll feel weird. It feels weirder than it sounds.
Complex. Yeah. I mean.
So there you go.
Awesome. That
it shows a better understanding. Even mathematicians screw this up, where they don't understand that it's, you know, the intention of the name. A complex number is that it's made of parts.
Nope, I very subtle, but very different meanings. So that's yeah. Very, very cool. All right, this topic for today is, I know it's one that really Tim suffers when people conflate these two words or two constructs, and it impacts everybody and everything they do, and that is hazard versus risk.
Right.
Because we all judge risk, whether we know it or not, with everything we do. We look at the benefits and the costs and the potential costs of doing certain actions whether it's getting up in the morning, going to your car, choosing where to eat, all those things have consequences. And there are hazards out there that, with a negative connotation, that cause problems or harm when they occur. And then there's a risk associated with what the likelihood of that hazard occurring is.
Exactly. And there's a formula that relates the two, a very simple linear formula, as you find in so many branches of engineering and science, that it's the risk times is equal to the hazard times the probability. So you have to take the hazard, multiply it by the probability to get the risk. And so many people conflate the two and make them the same. And the way it gets complicated when hazards and risk can happen in a particular situation. It's easier to understand if you separate it into something where it can't happen. For example, I talk about what's my, a hazard would be a great white shark, for example. However, sitting in my living room, it's not a risk.
Yes, you've taken risks to zero.
It seems so obvious. And you say, well, why isn't it a risk? Like, well, because the probability of my being attacked by a great white shark right now is so low.
Now, if you walked the 5 or 6 blocks to the beach from your house and swam out into the ocean.
Right. Or it would go up. And if I were dressed as a seal covered in blood in the Great Barrier Reef, the risk would increase
off Cape Town in South Africa, right? Yeah, it's all right. About location, location, location.
Right.
We're going to pause right here and take a look at a scene from Jurassic World 2 that illustrates what we're talking about so perfectly.
Relax. More likely to die riding on a horse than in a plane.
No, I'm not, because I won't get on a horse. My chances are zero.
Right, so this happens all the time, and I have this happen in meetings, and people will say, well, what about this, and what about that? Or they're trying to make something sound ridiculous by bringing up another hazard of some kind. And I say, well, you know, just because you've identified a hazard doesn't mean you've identified a risk that needs to be addressed.
And people are very good at finding hazards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're very good at going, that could fall on me, or you could fall over this, or you could trip, or this could hit you.
And it happens a lot when we've identified a risk, and they say, well, if that's a risk, then what about this? And they try to make it sound ridiculous, you know, so that happens a lot too. And it's like, well, you don't understand the probability that links the two.
It's the quantification of it that is difficult. And obviously the best people at this are actuaries. Right. Actuaries study risk, and revolves around understanding what the probability of is it occurring and how much it costs so that we can charge this much to cover. And there's your profit.
Right.
The delta between the two.
Yeah.
Lawyers should be very good at understanding the difference between hazard and risk. And when they consult with their clients, what risks they need to mitigate. Engineers should be really good at this as well. This is an important skill to have, not necessarily the quantification of the risk, but understanding the code documents and what the underlying baselines are for tolerable risk. Because that's really what we're talking about, right? Is you can't ever get risk to zero unless you just don't participate.
No, it's risk mitigation.
Yeah. And so, and you can't.
That's everything. You mitigate risk every time you get in the car.
Yep. You can't mitigate it all, but you can lower it to an acceptable level of risk.
Right.
And that's where I think the general public suffers from thinking that we can make highway safety a point where there's no fatalities. Well, the only way to do that is to get rid of the highway.
No, it's asymptotic. Exactly. You'll approach it. And the closer you get, the harder you have to try.
Yep. But eventually, even, you know, even going at 10 miles an hour, somebody's going to get in an accident that's going to kill them or hurt somebody. And so you can't chase the zero. So we have to understand there's a baseline level of acceptable loss that we tolerate as a society. And it's different from individual to individual. But one of the things that bothers me in the way the hazards are presented is rarely are the risks correlated. Right? It's things we can do to mitigate the hazard without expressing what percentage of risk we just negated, because we obviously didn't take it to zero. You need somebody who understands all of the different levels of scope. And that's where, as an engineer, I think we kind of fall into that. We often get pulled in as the only ones who understand the technical side in meetings.
Yeah. Well, when you look at the building code, for example, they try to find a uniform risk that we try to expose people to in all these various cases. You approach the entire building code, which covers so many different types of hazards, and you say, okay, I have one additional dollar to spend. Where should I spend it to do the most good, you know? And that's exactly how this whole thing works. Our building code marches towards zero over time. We are slowly, as society can afford to, slowly tightening the screws and making everything uniformly all the way across the board a little bit better, a little bit at a time. So it's an interesting way of approaching it. But I mean, you get the people who are the wind specialists, the seismic specialists, the, you know, people doing snow load analysis and things like that. they all understand their own disciplines, but the fact is the code has to establish the levels where it levels them all off and makes them all equally dangerous. And we can't address one really well and leave the other ones as really sketchy. You want to make it so that you've made yourself as uniformly safe as possible.
Yeah, and I think the code does a good job of trying to normalize across the different risks that are present and the hazards that are available. And
it's pretty impressive, really. Yeah,
I mean, and you can be in California and you can have very good seismic criteria that makes sense because it's a high probability event compared to a hurricane. And then in Florida, you can have a code that works for high probability events there. And I've harped on fire protection engineers before, even though I know some of them and they're so smart, but it's the fire code that like drives me nuts. And they live in a bubble. The NFPA lives in their own little bubble, and they do so many things to further fire protection at the detriment to other systems in the building. And which is why it's not part of the building code. There's only small references to it. And then the municipality screwed up by adopting all of NFPA in some situations. And that's the problem, is when you're hyper-focused on your risks and how to mitigate them, you don't care about anybody else. It's an important skill to understand the difference between risk and hazard. And that's really easy. I think that's not too much to expect from people. But then managing risk, you don't manage hazards. You never manage hazards unless you're eliminating them. You manage the risk. And it's tough to have a conversation with somebody who thinks the baseline's always zero when the baseline's almost never zero. I can design 10,000 columns, and you know, if we're outside the three deviations, one of those columns is probably going to have an issue. But there's so many.
I remember trying to explain to people about the difficulty in understanding the statistical aspect of it too. And one of the ways I used to do it was I would talk about how you establish the baseline for safety for Disneyland's rides, and I would say, if we establish the baseline of we wanted a 1 in a million chance of killing somebody on any given ride,
well, Disneyland would kill 80
people a year. And it's funny because you say to somebody 1 in a million, they're like, to society, we use that as a way of saying it's impossible. It's not going to happen, right? But then if I come back to the same person and say, hey, we've designed this park to kill 80 people a year, how do you feel about that?
Or I'd take 1 in a million odds in the lottery.
Yeah. And they would say, you know, oh gosh, 80 people. Can we do any better?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So yeah, 1 in a million is not nearly good enough for that. Even though it's used synonymously with impossible to occur in society.
Yeah, with a very limited set of objects, 1 in a million is a pretty high goal. But when you're talking about tens of millions of people a year.
Yeah, it's the big numbers. And that's what engineering often comes down to, is people who are used to dealing with numbers that are larger than you can perceive.
So that's our boring code speech. Now we've got kind of a I don't know how controversial this is, because I got online and I made some posts on a blog somewhere. And of course, some people thought this was horrible. but we have kind of twin fun topics that really relate to each other. And this really came about because Tim and I were talking about the scale of the Matterhorn at Disneyland and what scale the Matterhorn was built to relative to the real Matterhorn. So the Matterhorn at Disneyland is what, like 199 feet tall?
No.
Or is it 150 something?
It's about 143 feet or something like that. Yeah.
Right. And I didn't look it up, but the real Matterhorn's like, what, 15, 20,000 feet tall elevation?
It's like 14,000, I think it is.
Right. So that leads you to go, it's a 1/100.
I remember hearing it in meters once. I think it was 9,000. Well, anyway.
It's like 1/100 scale or something like that. If you just say, oh, here's the elevation of the Matterhorn, and there's the elevation of our Matterhorn.
Level.
Yep. And there's the height of our Matterhorn. Why does that not write? Why is it not a 1/100 scale?
Well, the funny thing is it'd be so much easier to understand if we'd built Disneyland in Denver.
Yes, right? This is true. Yeah.
Then we would say, well, hell, it's a 1/2 scale attraction in Denver.
Because it's 6,000 feet tall.
Yeah.
So,
and that's exactly why. And also the portion of the peak that was built there is not the entire, even that you can see from Zermatt. It's just a hunk of it, of the upper portion of it.
Yeah.
So it's certainly, we didn't build it from you know, anywhere near sea level.
Yeah, so it's not the Alps. It's not the continental plate that it sits on. We only built kind of the prominence of, well, we didn't build it, but Disneyland only built the, Wheeler and Gray built the Matterhorn.
In 1959.
The Matterhorn.
It's been a little while now, hasn't it?
Yes. So it's really a much larger scale model of the Matterhorn because it's only a small cross section of it.
And I've made an attempt at trying to scale it by using Google Earth and trying to align photographs of it with the 3D model of it that's in Google Earth and picking points. Calling out elevations and scaling the two. And I got kind of close-ish.
Well, I assume some of the features are exaggerated.
Yeah, well, you know, above a certain height, it's reasonably good, actually. There's little signature prominences that they picked up on when they did it that you can line it up with. And I got about 1/70th, it turns out, which is funny because it's, you know, a bigger model than we always call it out to be. Usually it's the other way around.
Yes.
In this case, it's actually a larger scale model than we always say that it is.
And that, with the announcement like a month ago about Mount Everest changing its elevation, its official elevation, that
it
kind
grew,
of
grew, right?
Yeah. I think it grew like 10 feet or 10 meters, something like that. So Tibet and China now agree on what the elevation of, and notice it's elevation, not height. The elevation of Mount Everest is
30,000 sea level,
29,000 feet or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And so, in relationship to this whole idea about the Matterhorn not being to scale based on elevation, it's based on a certain chunk of the mountain. I feel like measuring mountains or judging the grandeur of a mountain based on its elevation is not as accurate as maybe we could be. And so, because Everest sits on a lot of other stuff than just the prominence of that mountain out of the ground. And my corollary to this, that we don't call a skyscraper in Denver the tallest building in the world, even though it sits 4,000 feet above Burj Khalifa, because we measured from the base of a discernible elevation. And we should do the same thing for mountains.
You know, it may be the case that the Petronas Towers are still the tallest because, you know, if you measure from the center of the earth, they're closer to the equator.
If we measure from the center of the earth, it's all just noise at the level of the earth. So there's an alternate method for measuring the height of mountains. And it's called the prominence of the mountain. And I don't think it goes far enough because basically if you're the tallest mountain on your continent, you're still the tallest mountain.
Mm-hmm.
It's the shorter mountains that get penalized because you're going to either a higher peak. It's wherever there's a saddle and that saddle has to lead up to a taller mountain. And so if you look at the lists of height or elevation versus prominence, they're like the same list. And I'm like, well, that's not the way. That's not what we're talking about. Basically, the tallest point on that continent gets to go down to sea level. And to me, that defeats the purpose. Because I'm impressed by Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa, which only sits like 100 feet lower. But the Hawaiian Island, if you look at it, if you were to drain the ocean, is an impressive mountain because it is taller than Everest from the base of the seafloor.
Right.
It has very steep sides. It's a huge solitary mountain. It's impressive. It's like the tall people who stand next to short people to make them look even taller. So we've, I know that Tim and I have kind of roughed out some systems that may work, whether it's you just take a, you know, a diameter of 50 miles from the center and you just take the lowest point, or you go out in pie-shaped directions from the, you know, like 5-degree segments, and anytime you hit like an uphill that's appreciable, I don't know, 1 foot out of 10, you call it, that's the low point that you're going to, you know, so whatever that lowest point is now becomes your measurement of height. And then Mauna Kea blows everything away.
It's always tricky because I always think about it in terms of a mountain in the Himalayas, just surrounded by a lot of noise, a lot of mess there, versus these isolated prominences that exist when you think of like Mount Fuji.
Yeah. Or even Kilimanjaro is very impressive because it's plain.
I was going to mention that one. Yeah.
Straight just up
above the plain. Yeah. And here in California, Mount Shasta, just standing, you know, solitary above mm-hmm. the plain, things like that. So, you know, should those get an advantage or something like that? You know,
it's not that I don't recognize the highest point on Earth is Mount Everest. It's that is not a measure of how grand the mountain is. It's a poor correlation to how grandiose that prominence really is. As we said, there's several mountains that look much mm-hmm. more impressive because you can get really far back and still see, you know, but
it looks really tall. Yeah.
Yeah. In the Himalayas, you can't get that far back and still see Everest. There's a lot of stuff in its way. So that's my two cents about it. I really don't care enough to, to even know the exact change in the height of Mount Everest, but I'm a Mauna Kea believer that's the most impressive mountain on our planet. So that is what it is. I mean,
well, one of these days we'll drain the planet and you'll be vindicated.
That's right. That's right. You know, dangerous things. Do you have a dangerous thing that wouldn't exist today if we hadn't been invented a long time ago? What do we accept?
Give me an example.
So I think swimming pools. I think if swimming pools hadn't been invented and some company came out and said, you know what, we're going to dig a hole full of water in your backyard and it'll drown a bunch of six-year-olds and younger. But I don't think we'd tolerate that if it were invented today.
Yeah, I mean, cars seems like the obvious one.
Yeah, we've done that.
You're
one
gonna
before.
You're going to give people driver license. They can go how fast? How much do they weigh?
Yeah.
What's to stop these people? Yeah, cars were invented today. Absolutely not.
Yeah, I think you cheated, though. I think they gave that one last time.
Oh, was that I don't know. That's the one I always think of. Sorry.
Yeah, any kind of vehicle, but yeah, I was like, swimming pools, those are pretty dangerous, and we tolerate it. The other one is stages, like a theatrical stage, mm-hmm. because those don't meet any code as far as the fall off on the edge. They're much taller than is permissible by code, but they're grandfathered in. The code allows you to have them, even though you can walk off the edge of those without any trouble, like Kelsey Grammer did at the California Adventure opening.
I don't remember that.
You don't remember that?
No.
At the media opening? Because it had the original stage had those star-shaped front edge.
Oh.
And it wasn't
straight across. The Hyperion Theater.
Yeah, and he misstepped.
He thought the black portion was still solid. He thought it was just painted on.
Yeah, I think he whispered a non-Disney word. But I'm sure there's a YouTube video out there of it. We'll have to find that, because that was a classic moment. All right, Tim. Well, it's late. It's like midnight here in Florida.
Yeah, I'm still fine.
It's one of those days. Yeah. Any last words of wisdom? I'm going to take that as a no.
You know, the next time you get trapped in the complex numbers.
Yes. Of all the things to
maybe
complain about, the way
maybe
we
you're
say
dabbling
it,
in alternating circuits. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Yes. Of all the things to complain about from pronunciation, complex numbers is a that one's that
yeah.
one like, it made the
it's
list.
It's kind of useful on YouTube if you're into watching math videos, like some of us might be. But other than that, not too useful.
All right.
I'll find someone who cares one of these days.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you a pity care. It's interesting.
Thanks.
And I applaud your diligence in being able to pick that one up. That's an impressive skill right there. All right. Well, Rankled Engineers out. We'll see you later, Tim. Everyone have a good one. Bye.